The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Richard Stoltzman, probably the world's greatest clarinet player. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I just read the lead article for National Geographic magazine's December issue. Isn't it remarkable how magazines are actually prophets putting out their December issues in mid-November? How do they know? Anyway, the lead article is about King David, or as the headline puts it, The Search for King David. New discoveries in the Holy Land. The premise of the article is that archaeologists in Israel are arguing about King David, a hugely important biblical figure for Jews and Christians and Muslims, and that a debate rages as to whether David was a great and powerful king in a rich capital city of Jerusalem, or merely a tribal chieftain, a kind of glorified gang leader in a small, impoverished microstate. If you visited Israel in recent years and gone to Jerusalem, oh, and by the way, if you've been to Israel recently and not visited Jerusalem, you're in a very small subcategory indeed, and, well, nuts. Anyway, you might have stopped by and seen the City of David excavations just south and slightly east of the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. This dig, one of the most significant in the world today, is under the leadership of archaeologist Eilat Mazar. She's the granddaughter of the legendary Israeli archaeologist Binyamin Mazar, who excavated Beit Shearim in the Galilee, the first dig ever sponsored by a Jewish institution, and Ein Gedi near the Dead Sea, and the most important of all Israeli excavations, the area near the Kotel, the western wall in Jerusalem, holiest place in the world for Jews, just west and south of the Temple Mount. It's a family business, by the way. Eilat Mazar's cousin, Amichai Mazar, won the 2009 Israel Prize for Archaeology for his amazing digs at Beit She'an and Timna. Anyway, so the National Geographic article documents that Eilat Mazar is currently digging and discovering in a very important neighborhood herself, the legendary Ir David, the true city of David. The fascinating story goes like this. In the 1500s, when the Ottoman Turks took control of Israel, the Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent decided to build a new wall around the famous, historic, sacred old city of Jerusalem. He commissioned his court architect to rebuild the protective wall and make Jerusalem safe, and he specifically instructed him to incorporate all of the areas that had been considered part of the great but small city throughout its thousands of years of history. Of particular importance to the Sultan was the city's close association with King David, conqueror of Jerusalem from the Jebusites around the year 1000 BCE, 2,500 years before Suleiman and over 3,000 years ago now. The walls were built, and today they are still magnificent, a World Heritage Site and a tourist destination not to be missed. Unfortunately, the architect of Jerusalem's walls, Suleiman the Magnificent's court architect Sinan Pasha, mistakenly followed a route for the new walls. The same magnificent walls you can see today surrounding the old city, the Ir Ha'atika of Yerushalayim, the City of Gold, Jerusalem, which was completed in the year 1542. Anyway, the architect followed a route that made sense to him, reflected the geography of the site, and included all the areas then inhabited. But it left out a hilly area to the south and east of the main city, which it turned out included the original Ir David, the true city of David, one of the oldest sections of Jerusalem.
By the way, when I first visited Jerusalem in 1976 as a 15-year-old, I was told that there were two Ottoman architects, and when their failure to include the city of David within the walls of Jerusalem was discovered, they were both executed. Apparently, this is another one of those tour guide legends that go viral. Anyway, in recent years, the area of the city of David has become a very, very important dig with significant political implications. How, you may ask, can a 3,000-year-old heap of rocks and dirt possibly have important political implications in the 21st century, the era of Facebook and Twitter? Good question. Works like this. For the better part of 40 years and more, a variety of characters, Palestinian politicians and archaeologists, renegade Israeli archaeologists, garden variety Arab anti-Semites, even European minimalist archaeologists from, of all places, Copenhagen, Denmark, all have been working hard to prove that ancient Israel wasn't important, that King David never existed, and especially that Jews didn't live in the Middle East in ancient times. In fact, we finally got there about, 3 weeks ago. All of that hard work has been designed to prove that contemporary Jews, especially the modern state of Israel, have no claim to Israel as a Jewish state or to Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, as a Jewish country, and that the roots don't go back 3 millennia to King David or even earlier. Unfortunately for these anti-Israel archaeologists and their publicists throughout the anti-Semitic world, a series of finds in recent years, and especially the past year, have badly damaged their scholarly credibility. 16 years ago at Tel Dan in the north of Israel, a stone inscription was found, carbon dated to the 9th century BCE, that talks about a king from the house of David. Scarcely possible if David didn't exist and wasn't really a king and didn't found the house. And in the last 12 months, excavations at a variety of sites in Israel and Jordan, exciting ones, have demonstrated that a vibrant, diverse Israelite kingdom existed at least as far back as the 10th century, the time of David and King Solomon. The centerpiece of all this archaeological intrigue is the city of David itself, just outside the walls of the old city and a stone's throw away from the huge throngs of tourists who visit the many fantastic sites in the old city of Jerusalem. The dig has unearthed a huge palace, 60-foot-high walls that date back to the 10th century BCE, exactly the time that King David, according to the Bible, was supposed to have built his royal palace in Jerusalem. That find is supported by evidence from other 10th century sites around the country and in other countries. A huge copper mine in Jordan, necessary for the bronze used so frequently in David and Solomon's time. Other walled cities of similar construction, corresponding to many of the places mentioned as contemporaneous in the Bible itself. Essentially, the National Geographic article makes it clear that the anti-David camp is on the defensive, nearly on the run these days, that the biblical minimalists have been disproven, and that while there is still no definite hard evidence of King David, say no coin or inscription from the 10th century with his name on it, no throne or crown, no lock of his hair or beard or a piece of his harp, it sure looks like David existed and was king in a palace in Jerusalem at exactly the right time. This article, as all articles are in National Geographic, is well written. Gorgeous photographs on beautiful, heavy, glossy paper, usually reserved for coffee table books we give at Hanukkah. And as is common with any and every article that reflects on Israel in National Geographic, an otherwise excellent magazine, it has a slightly anti-Israel bias. For example, although it's clear throughout the story that there is more evidence of David's existence than ever before, and that there was a strong Israelite kingdom 3,000 years ago with its capital in Jerusalem, the little boxes of text that they excerpt, you know, to punch out the article for you when you read it, say things like, many excavations take place in eastern Jerusalem, where Palestinians stand to be displaced if such projects morph into Israeli settlement claims. Or, despite decades of searching, archaeologists had found no solid evidence that David or Solomon ever built anything. These little boxes conveniently leave out the fact that the article itself makes it clear that there is a lot of solid new evidence that David and Solomon built quite a lot. And they omit the fact that what is at stake is the truth about history. Pretending that it isn't so serves no one well. You know, I'm used to biased reporting on Israel, aren't we all? But I have to say, this article by Robert Draper was not particularly biased. It took pains to highlight the supposed danger to Palestinians from the truth. But, you know, that is so often a problem for Palestinians, isn't it? And it certainly played up the fact that Israeli archaeologists were arguing about the meaning of the finds. Imagine that. Jewish scholars arguing. That's only been happening since the days of the Mishnah, probably since the time of King David himself or Moses. The cool thing is, even National Geographic had to admit that it sure looks like King David was not only a real historical figure and Jewish, but also that he ruled a real kingdom from a real palace, and that we Jews have been in Israel for at least 3,000 years, and, by golly, in East Jerusalem for that long, too, which is only about 1,000 years longer than any Arabs existed anywhere around Israel. Well, so much for the "we were here first, and you are stealing our land" types. Now, perhaps, we can get back to the practical reality of two peoples sharing a land that was Jewish first, but which now includes both Arabs and Jews, now and for the foreseeable future. Perhaps that's even how King David would have thought about it. He was, after all, a pretty pragmatic guy. Well, to play us in this morning from our pre-Hanukkah musical preview, Hanukkah starts less than a week after Thanksgiving, sundown on December 1st, here's the Levies and their modern Hanukkah tune, Lotka Clan, from the album Hanukkah Rocks, written and recorded in, no kidding, 8 nights.
Hanukkah, I know it's gonna be all right. Everyone's together tonight, feeling good, it's Hanukkah. Two candles lit, the holiday's just begun. We're in for lots of fun. The time has come, it's Hanukkah. Sun is setting, get home as fast as you can.
That was the Levies, Lotka Clan. Hanukkah's coming soon. Also coming soon is the outstanding clarinetist Richard Stoltzman, probably the world's greatest player of this most evocative instrument. Find out if he thinks the clarinet is Jewish when we return in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. I was out and about the other day and noticed one of my favorite ice cream stores was out of business. Not only did it depress me because I was in the mood for mint chocolate chip, but it also got me to thinking, how does a hometown restaurant survive these days in a city changing as fast as Tucson? I mean, we got stores being forced out with big rents and huge chains coming in with even huger advertising budgets. It seems to me a place like Tucson kind of starts to lose its individuality. But don't lose faith. At Mama's, we're still your neighborhood pizza restaurant. If you've got a request or a problem, you don't need to call some fancy office in California. You just call Vinny or me or one of the kids, and you're at the top. I'm not kidding. At Mama's, we have great tasting food at hometown prices, and we always will. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
The greatest Hanukkah on earth is coming up fast. It's coming to Temple Emmanuel, Sunday, December 5th at 4:30 p.m. Join us for the largest, best, and most enjoyable Hanukkah celebration of all, featuring a wonderful array of music, theater, dance, stories, and magic. Hanukkah comes to life at the Temple's 12th Annual Festival of Lights as never before. Start by helping light the giant outdoor menorah on Country Club Road at 4:30 p.m. Then rejoice with the Avanim Rock Band, the Tucson Girls Chorus, Temple Emmanuel Youth and Teen Choirs, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and an array of great performers. Bring a menorah and six candles as we light up the night in a gorgeous finale that'll make this the most memorable Hanukkah celebration ever. The Hanukkah event is open to all. It's co-sponsored by KGUN 9 TV. If you want to join us for a great traditional brisket and latke dinner afterwards, call the Temple at 520-327-4501 and make a reservation with your credit card. Remember, the show is free, but call to come for dinner. That's Sunday, December 5th, beginning at 4:30 p.m. The centennial edition of the greatest Hanukkah on Earth, 12, at Temple Emmanuel. Call 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish, two-time Grammy Award-winning clarinetist Richard Stoltzman. His virtuosity, technique, imagination, and communicative power have revolutionized the world of clarinet playing. It says so right here in your bio, so it has to be true, right?
I don't know. My mom wrote that song.
I would hope so. I mean, not that she would tell you that to your face, but behind your back, only the best. Stoltzman gave the first clarinet recitals in the history of both the Hollywood Bowl and Carnegie Hall. 1986 became the first wind player to be awarded the Avery Fisher Prize. One of today's most sought-after artists, he has performed with a remarkable and extraordinary variety of not only classical performers, but jazz groups ranging from Chick Corea to Spyro Gyra to Mel Torme. Frequently performs with his own son, Peter John Stoltzman, a talented classical and jazz pianist and composer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I don't know about you, and maybe because I grew up playing it, but I always think of the clarinet as a Jewish instrument. Is it?
Yeah, it probably is. I know that my most fun when I was in high school playing was with my friends, especially Dave Lieberman and Gary Robbins and Sid Lieberman and Jerry Samuels and Ed Wise and Dan Lederer. We had bands that we played in all the time, and I even got to pick up a few, you know, shekels doing a couple of bar mitzvahs. But the joy of I think, you know, the joy of the human soul is really expressed through the clarinet in many ways, and certainly with the klezmer voice that you know cries out, and the clarinet is the prime singer, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, through the preeminent klezmer instrument, how did that happen? Musically speaking, do we really know?
I think all through the history of the clarinet, which is not that old, it's not an old instrument like compared to violin or something. It was invented in around 1700. Johann Christoph Denner, and then more keys were added, and so on. But you know, so many of let's just say like the early jazz proponents like Artie Shaw and Benny Goodman and band leaders who played the clarinet and swung and sang the blues with it. You just feel that the instrument understood the sadness and joy and the joy and sadness and that sense of being able to express the size of the human spirit. And I think the clarinet, you know, mainly one of the things is the clarinet has this vocal quality that's somewhat due to the fact that it is a unique overtone system. It's based, I don't want to get too scientific, but it's based on the 12th. And we all know about the 12th. And this octave and a fifth, which is the supporting column of the clarinet, causes it is a unique combination of overtones that allows it to, of course, sound like the clarinet, but also sound like the flute, or sound like the oboe, or sound like the French horn, or sound like an alto saxophone, or most of all, sound like the human voice. And that's something that has got to, you know, be like a prime reason to have it become part of the Jewish tradition, part of the klezmer tradition, and so on. But it's not historic.
That's a pretty darn good analysis, though. We will talk much more with the outstanding clarinetist, Richard Stoltzman, a little bit later this morning. We'll talk about the krechs a little more, too, when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Sunday, November 21st, UA Presents hosts an unforgettable evening of classical music with Menachem Pressler and the New York Chamber Soloist Orchestra with Richard Stoltzman at 7 p.m. at Centennial Hall. The one-night-only performance features the world's foremost clarinetist, two-time Grammy winner Richard Stoltzman, and world-renowned pianist Menachem Pressler, nominated for 6 Grammy Awards. Pressler escaped Nazi Germany and immigrated to Israel, where he learned piano, leading to a career that has spanned nearly 60 years. With the New York Chamber Soloist Orchestra, an outstanding ensemble of distinguished virtuosi, these two famous musicians will present 2 Mozart concertos and a Brahms sonata. Tickets are available at the UA Presents box office at 520-621-3341 or online at uapresents.org. That number again, 621-3341. For Menachem Pressler, Richard Stoltzman, and the New York Chamber Soloists Orchestra. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. Believe it or not, Hanukkah starts a week from Wednesday night, December 1st, with candles and latkes and dreidels for all. That means there are now just 11 more shopping days till Hanukkah. And even with 8 full days and nights of the Festival of Lights, that means we will not even be close to being able to shop for Hanukkah presents in the after-Christmas sales. In fact, you can shop for Christmas presents in the after-Hanukkah sales this year. In fact, Black Friday takes on greater Hanukkah present purchasing relevance than it has in any year in recent memory. Well, we have another holiday besides Hanukkah previews to celebrate this morning, the upcoming festival of Thanksgiving. Our pilgrim forefathers based Thanksgiving on the Jewish biblical celebration of Sukkot, Harvest Feast of Booths, and any holiday where you get together with your family and overeat must, by definition, be Jewish. We have a great deal to be thankful for today, not least of which is the magnificent clarinet playing of our guest Richard Stoltzman. Here's a sample. Thank you. That was our guest, Richard Stoltzman, showing off on clarinet with the Boston Pops. Definitely worth giving thanks for. We welcome our maven, our expert on Israel, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi. Boker Tov.
Boker Or. We've been talking, and you've been writing a little bit about the demonizing of Israel in the press and the world public opinion, an attempt to isolate Israel, push Israel away from the mainstream. A lot of debate as to what the right response is, but surely one of the best ways to respond is to talk about what Israel has really contributed to the Jewish people.
Yes, I think this is really the essence of this campaign against Israel. If we would go back in time, for instance, to the year 1965, and we would ask Jewish people around the world to give us one picture, one photograph that represents more than all for them the Jewish identity, I think most of them would remember one picture. It would be a picture of a young boy with his hands up, standing in Varsha with a Nazi soldier pointing a gun at him, and no adult around to come and help him. And this picture, in a way, symbolizes the Jewish people as, well, you might say, as a weak people, or maybe as a victims. Certainly not as a proud people. Now, if we would go with our special time machine forward in time to the year 1970 and go across the world and ask the same question, give us one photograph, one picture that represents Jewish people for you, people would probably give us a different picture. The picture that would give at that point would be a picture of three Jewish soldiers standing near the Western Wall with tears in their eye, with their head lifted, proud and very excited after liberating the Western Wall. I think this picture brings us the essence of what the state of Israel, the Jewish state of Israel, gave us, the Jewish people. It gave us the ability to be a people like the leading peoples of the world, like the people of Italy, the people of France, the people of America, people that are proud, that they have their own country, their own homeland, and can be proud of themselves as people. This is why I think the demonizing of Israel that takes place now across the United States and across the world is so dangerous. Because what this demonizing campaign is trying to do is to disconnect between the Jewish people and Israel and bringing back the Jewish people to the place where they feel ashamed, where they feel frightened, when they're saying, well, this is Israel and it's not us. We are something else. We are no longer proud of being Jewish. We're no longer proud of having our own country, our own state. And I think that's the main risk.
You know, I'm reminded that contrast between the two images of comment my dad used to make up until about the founding of the state of Israel, really up until the 1920s, 1930s, the song that people thought of as the most Jewish song in the world was Eli, Eli, Lama Zavtani. You know, my God, why have you forsaken me? Eli, Eli, Lama Zavtani. Really quite a sad song. After that, it became Hava Nagila, which came from Israel, was written in Israel, and seemed to capture the spirit. So really, it's that change to a sense of pride and belonging that is so central in our, in really any Jew's life. Thanks, Guy. We will continue this next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Weiler of Janos, the J-Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
The holiday season is nearly upon us, well upon us, actually. Great time for parties, great time for gift certificates.
Yes, it is. So when you're thinking about gift certificates, we have gift certificates to Janos, J-Bar, Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. We also have private party space at all of the restaurants. So if you're doing holiday entertaining, we've got several private party spaces available at Janos and J-Bar. And we're going to be doing our private parties downtown, upstairs, in Terry Etherton's gallery. Gorgeous space.
Beautiful spaces, great food, great gifts, great parties. What's the number to call?
Call us at 615-6100. Then you can go to any of the restaurants or go online at Janos.com.
Janos.com, best way to do it. See you there. Thanks, Janos.
Happy holidays, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about India based on your fairly recent trip there. You know, oh, by the way, Israel now has all kinds of trade ties with India, which is bringing Jews and Hindus into closer and closer contact. We were talking about the caste system a little bit, which is, those of us who don't know very much about India, one of the first things you think about, well, there's Brahmins at the top and untouchables at the bottom, and people can't move back and forth. And that is a stereotype. How true is it today, and what does it really mean?
Well, turns out, first of all, in parentheses, that Israel is India's largest arms supplier. So
yes.
When you talk to Indians about Israel, they say, oh, thank God, they sell us all the arms we need. So, okay. They may not know much else about Israel.
Interesting aspect
right.
of the Israeli
I mean, they believe that, you know, outreach. Israel is helping defend them from the
Pakistan,
marauding Pakistanis,
right?
And Islamic terrorists and all that. So, okay. The caste system, as it manifests itself today, is basically four castes only. The Brahmins are the priestly class. The Rajputs, the warrior class. You automatically go to the Indian version of West Point if you're a Rajput. The Kshatriyas, who are the merchant class, and the Dalits are the so-called formerly untouchables, who are often very wealthy. Gandhi and then Nehru introduced sort of quota systems to make sure that a certain percentage of plum jobs in the government, a certain percentage of seats in parliament, a certain amount of power would go to these people who had previously been considered untouchables, so that over the past half century or so, they have acquired a lot of wealth and a lot of clout. I mean, basically, nobody gets elected to any serious position in India without the support of the entire caste of the so-called untouchables. Now, it is true that people Wow. tend not to marry between castes, but these days, caste is seen largely as a kind of quaint relic of the past, when the caste into which you were born determined how you would spend your life, either as a military guy, as a merchant, as a cleaner or a sweeper or whatever, or as an intellectual, as a scholar, as a Brahmin, serving religion rather than state. So the question arose actually from one of our Brahmin guides. Isn't this just like Judaism with its priestly class and its sort of middle class who washes the feet of the priests and it's everybody else who are like our untouchables? Well, you know, yes and no, in the sense that those divisions in Judaism are very ancient. They did have to do with the function, the main function of what Jews had instead of clergy, which was people who ran the temple. And the whole system of sacrifices and collecting taxes and all that, that was the job of priests and Levites.
You know, Kohanim, like, you know, Rabbi Kohan, that
right.
kind of thing, right?
Right. So in that sense, there's some historic parallel. On the other hand, the ordinary Israelites never considered themselves untouchables or peasants or banned from any particular profession. And conversely, none of those three groups of people automatically went into the military. So, you know, similarities,
and,
yes,
and
but
they,
huge differences.
They also
as well.
Married between the castes. It was never a problem to do so. You know, it might change your status, but it didn't. It wasn't prohibited degree ever.
However, there are certain things that Kohanim aren't supposed to do, like
right.
divorce and touching dead bodies and whatever. So
correct.
There are some restrictions, extra restrictions, just like there are on Brahmins in India.
Huh. Very interesting parallel and interesting differences. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Jaime, a wealthy Jewish guy, buys a fabulous home with over 50 rooms. He brings in a decorator, hires a local workman to decorate the place. When the job is finished, Jaime is delighted, but realizes he forgot something. He didn't put mezuzahs on the doors. He rushes out, buys 50 mezuzahs, and shows the decorator where to put them, on the right-hand side of each door, not the bathrooms, of course, with the top pointed in, and so on. He's really worried the decorator will screw up the paint or won't put up the mezuzahs correctly. Goes out for a few hours and comes back and sees the job has been carried out beautifully. He's so pleased, he gives the decorator a bonus. But as the decorator is walking out, he says to Jaime, "Glad you're happy with the job, sir. By the way, I took out all the guarantees that were in the little boxes and put them on the table for you." Well, you see, mezuzahs have a parchment inside with a shema, and you're supposed to put it on the doorpost and, forget it. All right, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and keep kissing that mezuzah. And now a word of Torah. Joseph is one of the truly spectacular figures in the Bible. Brilliant, talented, arrogant, gifted with remarkable vision and tremendous administrative skill. A youth of great promise and then a man of fate and determination, he survives enormous trauma to reshape two nations' intertwined destinies. A remarkably contemporary character, Joseph is a brazen, spoiled boy who transforms into a subtle and deep man. In a change of pace and literary emphasis, Joseph will prove to be the principal character of the last four weekly portions in Genesis, transition to the long narrative of Moses that fills the rest of the Torah. Interestingly, the Joseph story has been called the first truly modern piece of literature, filled with contemporary authorial techniques, delineating character and plot, foreshadowing. Each segment ends in a cliffhanger. The interplay of storylines and locations makes the whole narrative vibrant and rich and exceedingly compelling. This modern style is particularly impressive, since the book of Genesis was written at least 2,500 years ago. Anyway, in Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, and Vayechi, we find temptation and cunning, nobility and baseness, carelessness and probity all juxtaposed and then counterpointed thoughtfully. The foolish learn wisdom. The wicked grow to see the error of their ways. The impulsive learn restraint. And nothing is ever quite so simple as it seems initially. It's a great story, and it's great writing. The Joseph story stretches through a month of Torah, but it begins with a bang in this week's portion of Vayeshev. At the commencement of the Sedra, our great ancestor Jacob's beloved wife Rachel has died in childbirth, and in pained overcompensation, Jacob spoils Rachel's oldest son Joseph, giving him a famous coat of many colors, perhaps really an embroidered tunic, and using him as a tattletale spy on his older, tougher brothers. The brothers' revenge is swift this week. Away from their father's eye, they capture Joseph and sell him into slavery in Egypt, telling Dad that a wild animal killed him. After adventures that demonstrate Joseph's newfound virtue and really bad luck, this week's portion ends with Joseph stuck in an Egyptian prison, then is now a terrible place, Jacob in mourning, and all hope seemingly lost. Tune in next week, same Bible time, same Bible channel, to see what happens next. Well, Joseph will emerge, but not until he has gone through struggles that form him as a man. Richard Stolzman is a spectacular clarinetist, likely the best in the world. Find out how his Judaism has shaped his musicianship when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle.
It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The government of Israel has agreed to bring the approximately 8,000 Falash Mura Jews who remain in transition camps in Gondar, Ethiopia, to Israel over the next 4 years. It has been a controversial decision, but as President Benjamin Netanyahu said, these are the seeds of Israel, men, women, and children who currently find themselves in the worst living condition. This really is the case of a complex humanitarian crisis. We must prevent the emergence of additional refugee camps in Ethiopia. By the government's decision, there will be no additional organized Aliyah of Falash Mura members once this project is completed. Also in Israel, the great Talmud scholar Adin Steinsaltz has completed his Hebrew translation of the Talmud. We celebrated that with the Global Day of Jewish Learning a couple of weeks ago. The Talmud is the spine of Judaism, said Steinsaltz. It's a remarkable scholarly achievement. Jill Clayburgh, the outstanding actress whose greatest success came in films in the late 1970s and early 80s, my time, I guess, died last week from leukemia. She was just 66 years old. Jill Clayburgh was best known for her portrayals of strong, independent women in films like Starting Over, An Unmarried Woman, Semi-Tough, Portnoy's Complaint, Silver Streak, and I'm Dancing as Fast as I Can. I remember her for her starring role in the Broadway show Pippin, her first big break, opposite another Jewish actor, John Rubinstein, and in The Rothschilds before that with yet another Jewish actor, Hal Linden. She later starred on TV in a variety of roles. A fine actress, Jill Clayburgh grew up Jewish in New York, got her bachelor's from Sarah Lawrence. It's hard to believe she is gone. American-style donuts are making a second attempt at the Israeli market in time for Hanukkah after Dunkin' Donuts' spectacular failure to make a go of it in the Holy Land 10 years ago. Donuts have returned this year and are apparently making a go of it. Typically, Israelis eat sufganiyot, deep-fried jelly confections that are much denser than American donuts, just once a year at this Hanukkah time. But the Israeli-American food entrepreneur Zohar Norman, the man who introduced hummus to the American palate, came up with a plan to sell donuts outside of the main cities of Israel, and his Alonit company has a hit on its hands. Holy pastries for the Holy Land. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, the outstanding two-time Grammy Award-winning clarinetist Richard Stoltzman. Richard Stoltzman was the first clarinetist to give a recital at the Hollywood Bowl, which is from my native town, Los Angeles, and also in Carnegie Hall in New York. He became the first wind player ever awarded the Avery Fisher Prize. He has played with an astounding variety of classical artists and jazz performers. What do you like doing better?
I like being in front of an audience better than anything. So if it's a chance to play the clarinet with orchestra, I'm there. If it's a chance to play the clarinet, you know, in front of elementary school, I'm there. I just want. You practice so long. And my mother used to say, "Why are you still practicing? I don't understand why you're still practicing." And I said, "Ma, I have to stay with it, you know." But why do you have to stay with it? You have to stay with it so that you can still communicate what you feel through the instrument. And that communication has to be partially from you and partially from the audiences that you play for. And that's, for me, the most that's what I like to do the best, is to play for audiences.
You know, we'd be happy to have you out for Simchas Torah to play with our klezmer band. we'd even pay expenses. tell me, how did you first pick up a clarinet? Why a clarinet initially? You've described beautifully the incredible range and the way it's both human and matches all the other instruments, but why the clarinet initially?
Yeah, I don't have such a elaborate, I mean, glorious story. I found it underneath when I was a little kid, like the 2 or 3, and playing games and things. And I found underneath my mom and dad's bed a leather pouch which had the 5 parts of the clarinet in it. I remember distinctly the latch. In fact, when my mom moved to be close to us when she got older, we were cleaning the house, and I found that exact pouch. I couldn't believe it. I have it in my studio now.
Still under the bed?
No, it's under the bed. But why was it under the bed? Because my father had aspirations to play with a big band. He wanted to. He never really got the chance in a realistic way, but he kept the clarinet along with his tenor saxophone underneath the bed just in case Duke Ellington would happen to come by, or Count Basie, or anybody, and needed a doubler. So that's why the clarinet was there, and I found it to be wonderful as a little kid to just roll around on the floor and pretend like it was a toy or a microscope or a telephone or a telescope or something like that. And my dad found me and didn't punish me, and decided instead that maybe someday I could, you know, try one. And he rented me one, a metal clarinet that I couldn't break. And I began with the metal clarinet. I had always had good teachers, which was very, very, very important for me, which I'm trying to write some stories now about all the teachers. The teachers were the most important reason why I stayed with the clarinet. That and people saying that they liked it. I mean, starting with my grandma, I practiced. We only had one room where people slept, and that was my grandma's room. I slept in the bed with my grandma. I think my brother slept in there too. And then there was something called the den TV dining living room area, which is where my mom and dad slept on a convertible couch. And but there wasn't much, so I practiced in that room, and my grandma would sit in a corner. And, you know, I only realized this later. I just always was playing for somebody listening to me, even though the only thing she would do is either fall asleep, or sometimes she'd say, "That's nice," you know.
You know, I studied clarinet for 5 years, and by the end of it, I discovered that my great instrumental skill was singing. But the thing that they don't really teach you in preparing you for classical or even jazz is some of that sort of klezmer krech stuff that happens, you know, being able to slide and do some of that. I've heard fantastic clarinetists from the Soviet Union who really didn't read a note of music but could do that beautifully.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and great classical clarinetists who couldn't even try it.
Well, you know, when I first, probably most kids, well, I don't know nowadays, but when I was young, you know, you heard the glissando in Rhapsody in Blue. You said, I want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I want to do that. It's exciting. It's beautiful. It's unorthodox. And it sends a shiver down your spine. And so, you know, that was, so I wanted to do that. Exactly, that glissando, and then I guess I wanted to be in that spirit, what that glissando represented probably in my subconscious, which was a kind of freedom or a little bit, you know, not doing exactly the rules and everything. And so, I mean, my klezmer experience is more ersatz than really true klezmer playing. I think, you know, I admire the great klezmer players, and in fact, I had a student once who he wanted to be a classical player. His name is Joel Rubin, and he just didn't, you know, feel that this was going to be his destination, and I could feel that too. And I put him in touch with my clarinet teacher, Kalman Opperman, and Kalman Opperman immediately saw that this guy was should be and had to be a klezmer player, and he had started a group called Music from the New World or Old World or something like that, and lived in Berlin a long time, and now he's here in America. And when I hear him play you know, really klezmer music, it's so right.
You have a remarkable tone. What do you attribute it to?
sound. That I think, you know, that's the essence of it's from the breath, really, right? I mean, if we're not breathing, then we're not really part of this world. So what do you do when you breathe?
To do music,
you know, you just you inhale and you exhale. But with the reed vibrating, that little piece of bamboo, the breath then gets transformed, sort of magically, into tone, into sound, and the sound can be almost anything. It's created with the clarinet, it's created inside your mouth. It's inside the reed vibrates inside your mouth. So the sound comes from inside of this opening that allows yourself to speak. It allows you to sing. I remember playing a long time ago when I was teaching the California Institute of the Arts, a school that Walt Disney built called
CalArts.
Yeah, CalArts in Valencia, California.
Out near Magic Mountain.
Yeah. But this is before Magic Mountain had actually been built. And the North Indian teacher of flute and solfege came to a concert in which I played Schubert's Der Hirt auf dem Felsen, which is a piece for voice, piano, and clarinet. The beautiful thing about the spring will be coming. And this starts off with a little piano introduction and then one tone from the clarinet. And then it moves into this whole beautiful leader and 15-minute piece. But when this Indian man told me, he said, you know, I'd never heard any Schubert. I've never heard much Western music at all. But he said, I knew I was going to be okay when that first tone came out. And I knew what he meant, because when you go to an Indian concert, they usually start with a drone, and then they find a tone and hold it, strum it on their sitar or on their flute, and make it really, really, really be in tune with that drone, which is the same as saying being in tune with the vibrations of the perfect fifth, or in the case of the clarinet, in tune with the 12th. And in tune means being in touch.
In touch with the soul. I think of the Jewish word ruach, which means both breath and soul or wind. You know, it's all kind of connected.
There it is.
I could talk to you forever, I think, or listen to you forever, but we're nearly out of time. A quick question. You're a big Red Sox fan. Have they ever asked you to play the Star Spangled Banner?
I want them to please ask me. I don't know how to. I don't.
Theo Epstein is Jewish. You know, you should just call.
I don't know. I'm not. I'm not worthy, really. But I would love to. And if there's anybody out there listening who is the manager of the Red Sox, please, sometime. I'll do it like it can be a
spring
doublehead. It can be a day game. I don't care what it is.
A rain out replacement game.
Yes. I don't care. I practiced it. I'm ready to do it. I can do it. So
standing in the wings, ready to play the Star Spangled Banner for the Red Sox.
Yes.
I want to thank Richard Stilson for a fabulous visit here on Too Jewish, one of the really great instrumentalists in the world, wonderful clarinetist, delightful guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
Attention Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, formerly known as Cheder. Here's how. The State of Arizona Private School Tax Credit allows Arizona taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, allowing scholarships for children in kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at the Tucson Hebrew Academy and the Jewish Community Center. If you make your donation today, you'll get 100% of your money back on your Arizona state income tax. A tax credit is not a deduction. Rather, it's money that comes directly back to you in your state tax return. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. The deadline to take your tax credit is December 31st, so call or sign up online now.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Barbara Ribicoff-Gordon, the founder of the North American Conference on Ethiopian Jewry, NACOJ, which has worked long and hard to save tens of thousands of Ethiopian Jews from starvation and persecution, and helped bring so many to Israel and help them once they're there. She is the winner of the 2010, the 5771 Kohan Foundation Award for service to Klal Yisrael, the peoplehood of Israel, and she'll be here next week on Too Jewish. Our playout this morning comes from our guest, the splendid Jewish clarinetist Richard Stoltzman, Mozart's Clarinet Concerto. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a fabulous Thanksgiving, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.